Into sports.
20 yards out, Hurst to shoot. Don't shoot! Oh, what a goal from Fabinho! Wow!
Then get into the all-new OTB Sports app.
I think when he apologises to me, I probably will say hello to him, yeah. No.
Videos, sports news, live scores, interviews.
If Fabregas is going to come up to me in the street and give me some of the mouth that he would have given me on a football pitch, what would he do? He'd get a slap.
Plus, exclusive content on the OTB Podcast Network. The biggest names in sports, ready when you are. Search OTB Sports on your app store and download it now.
The OTB Podcast Network.
Oh, the shape that will get if you let all the fans down.
Can we not lock it?
It's a fact. I'm not playing mind games. I'm talking about facts.
I always said if I was Aladici, I would probably say I was more of a tactical genius.
The answer questions on anything. Religious, politics, health, you know, sexual problems.
Look at his face! Just look at his face!
None of you except for those two have done anything to justify the money that you earn. None of you! Disgrace!
And I suggest you shut up and show more football.
Enrique to Maradona. Different class. Different class!
He could really beat players like that. He could dribble, he could go past players. Now, Messi is a great player, and Ronaldo is one of the great modern players, but they don't beat players the way this fella could beat them. And there's nothing better than somebody who can beat the opposition.
Dancing feet. Still dancing feet. What a wonderful piece of play by Maradona.
Que no te viene mal, sonríe con tus jugadores de fútbol que están dejando muy en alto y muy en claro su prestigio.
Well, I played against Diego Maradona at Hampden in 1979 when he was 18. He was absolutely sensational. All the Scottish players came off the pitch talking about this kid that was destined to become a superstar, and they weren't proved wrong. I believe in my time watching football there have been four great, great players that have been on another planet from the rest. Pele, Beckenbauer, Cruyff and Maradona.
Oh, lovely play there as Redondo tries to go through. There's a show! Glorious goal! He's done it! Maradona! And look at these emotional scenes!
Piede sulla palla, Spezzi, parte il tiro! Rete! Rete! Maradona ha segnato! Magnifico calcio di punizione!
Have come in from set situations.
It's Maradona.
This fella's in the box.
Oh, he's done it! Just as you were saying, creating nothing unless he got into the box. He did it right on cue.
And Maradona gives Argentina the lead. The England players protesting to the referee for the little man who started it by walking past.
Fine montage work of Richie McCormack. This is Team 33 and we're chatting about the passing away of Diego Armando Maradona. It is a sad day, Colin Buig. It's one that we saw coming, so it's not a shock. But at the end of the day, no matter what you feel about Maradona's personal life, we've certainly lost one of the greatest players of all time.
Yeah, he did really well to make it to 60 in so many ways. And then in the obvious way, it's such a young age. So it did take everyone by surprise. And I know he's been very unwell recently. It was within the last fortnight that he was in hospital and we were all fearing the worst. And I think there was one or two rumours even the last fortnight. And then the news came through this week. And yeah, it's like anything. Yeah, it's like when you're not surprised by the news, but you're shocked when it happens and you can't prepare yourself for it. And I guess that's because Maradona transcended sport. I mean, there was nobody in my WhatsApp contact list yesterday who it would have been inappropriate to text about the news. I mean, that's the best way I can put it, is that everybody knows who he is. And it's not just that they've heard of the name. It's that they know a fair bit about him. I mean, like, everybody knows, like, you know, at least a paragraph worth of knowledge about Maradona. And that can range from how brilliant he was at the 1986 World Cup and almost single-handedly won the World Cup for Argentina. Or it can go to the modern day Maradona and his personal life and what happened to him and his involvement with the Camorra, with Napoli. There's so much to him. And of course, there was that great movie with Azif Kapadia released last year, which we covered on Team 33. And then there was another documentary, Maradona in Mexico, which I think is still on Netflix. And that was about him managing Dorados. And that's just me there in about a minute or two, really trying to briefly summarize Maradona. And it's really difficult to encapsulate it fully because that was the man.
Yeah, there's been a whole range of different tributes to Maradona over the last couple of hours on Off the Ball. We had Tim Vickery. We had Marcelo Mora Arejo. We had Graham Souness, who played against him. John Giles. And Gerard as well, who would have grown up watching Maradona. And what I found really interesting yesterday, and such a bizarre feeling of sadness when he passed, because I've never seen him play live. So I don't understand, and I don't know how to properly put into words why I felt emotional yesterday, or why it felt like I had lost someone when I didn't. I didn't lose anybody. I didn't know this person. I didn't see him play live, but there's something about him that I really connected with in terms of his career, watching and reading and just rewatching different clips of him and interviews and documentaries like the one of him in Mexico. The one of him in Mexico, which I would highly recommend anybody go and watch if it's still on Netflix. It's such a weird thing because we all know who Maradona was during his career. But post-career is almost as interesting because he's a shadow of the figure. He can barely walk, he's overweight, he's had drug issues, he's had heart issues, but he still seems to have that glint and that sort of happiness inside him somewhere.
Yeah, and we talked about it on Team 33 last year, was that documentary, Maradona in Mexico. And he would think from the title that it's about 86, but no, it's about his 1 year stint as Dorados manager, which is a very unfancied second division side in Mexico, in a very rough part of Mexico. And people were worried that when he took that job that he would succumb to all like he did in Naples, but he actually didn't. And the reason he didn't was because he was kept busy. And actually, as you mentioned there, one of our contributors since Maradona passed away was Tim Vickery. And Vickery was theorizing that maybe a part of Maradona's demise in the last few months is that he's been inactive because of COVID and he doesn't have any distractions or anything to keep him busy. And I think what you saw at Maradona was, and you know, none of us obviously know him, and I would say very few people do know him, or did know him. And I think he probably was running all his life from his worst vices because, you know, nobody was prepared. Nobody is prepared for that level of fame. And he was famous since he was a teenager. And then he became world famous by his late teens, right up until the day he died. And he'll always be famous. And I guess if you have absolutely zero privacy in your life, a toll will be taken that nobody really can understand. And he's probably in that top 1% of people in the history of mankind who are that famous, that the rest of us just talk about rather than to. But I think the reason that that documentary series, it's an 8-part series, about 35 to 40 minute long episodes, so it's pretty consumable, the Maradona in Mexico documentary, is that he confides in the press secretary of Dorados, this woman who I'd say is no older than 30. And he can just speak really candidly to her because she treats him like a human being, not with any great reverence of Maradona the footballer, just this guy called Diego in his late 50s, as he was at the time. And Maradona says, you know, he had this tendency to stare a million miles into the distance when he spoke passionately or very personally. And he was saying, can you imagine the player I would have been if it wasn't for the drugs? You know, and there was this feeling of regret from a guy who, as I say, was at the figurehead of his country's World Cup win in 86, who moved to Napoli after two bad years at Barcelona and took a very unfancied relegation-threatened side in Napoli and won two Serie A titles in the UEFA Cup and the Coppa Italia. Talk about an incredible career achieved in a very short space of time between the mid-80s and the early 90s. And yet all he had left was regret, seemingly. So that's, I guess, there's endless fascination. And there's a relatability in his personal anguish, I think, at times, which I think people resonated with, unlike that they would with, say, Pelé, who is the corporate man in comparison.
Yeah.
Now, would you prefer Pelé's life? Probably. But, you know, it made Maradona that much more interesting for the rest of us, you know?
Yeah, we'll be talking to Jonathan Wilson a little bit later on in the show about his upbringing and really about some of the sort of regrets of his career in terms of, did he achieve what he really set out to, or did he achieve what he could have? And the answer, probably no, because he wasn't successful at Barcelona. He was only successful for a short period of time in Napoli. And post that, he doesn't really have much in his career. And people will look at Maradona in terms of modern day footballers like Messi and compare their stats. But ultimately, firstly, you're comparing cross-generational talents. What Maradona had to come up against in terms of people tackling him. I mean, he was on cortisone for most of his career because he had to just play through the pain. The pitches were bad. The nutrition was bad. And Messi didn't really have to cope with any of that. But Messi is doing it at a more consistent and probably higher level for longer. So I don't like going into that who is better kind of conversation. But Maradona is one of these talents that we speak about so often in Team 33 that isn't defined by stats. He's not defined by how many goals he scored or how many assists he had. It's the character and why people love them and why people are interested in him, like the Eric Cantona's, like the Zidane's, these flawed, like the sort of different players from that era, like that had real issues with alcohol, with drugs, with different issues in their personal life that you can't look past. Ultimately, you cannot look past that and ignore them. But on the pitch, they came alive. And Maradona was certainly one of them.
And the other thing with Maradona too is, I mean, was he ever really fit? Because he was tackled so frequently from the earliest of ages. You know, I think he broke into the first team at 15 years of age back in Argentina. And, you know, it would have become very quickly apparent how talented he was. And back then, you know, talented players were not protected by referees, and the rules of the game were not sufficient to protect those players. So he would have been butchered basically a long time before Bilbao and after as well. So he was in cortisone injections all the time. That's shown in Azif Kapadia's documentary last year. And the guy was basically in physical pain as well as emotional pain for so much of his adult life. So he carried a huge burden. And yet, with all those fitness issues and pain that he was suffering, he still managed to deliver his country a World Cup and Napoli so much unprecedented success. So you would say that in many ways, he fulfilled the potential of most players, you know, and then some. But because he was so extraordinary, you would think, well, the world was his oyster. He could have won absolutely every game he ever played in because he was that good. I mean, he was a cartoon character full of talent. Like, he was an unrealistic player. And I know you were touching on it there at the start, and the like that. You never saw him live, but you were really affected by the news this week. And that's because, you know, footage of him is easily accessed, thankfully. There is loads of footage of him. Unlike, say, George Best, who, you know, it was exactly 15 years to the day that George Best died when Maradona died. And I remember that day in 2005 and how the world reacted, particularly in Britain and Ireland, to that news. And, you know, you had a limited amount of clips with Best, so you had to use your imagination somewhat. With Maradona, there's lots, thankfully. And the reason we all are impacted by it is because he is the reason why kids play football the way he played. He would just pick up the ball and just run past players. And, you know, that's it's a skill that you actually see less and less in elite football because it is about systems. I mean, you look at Jurgen Klopp and Pep Guardiola's teams, it's not really about the individual, it's about systems, and there's better teams for it, and as a result, just more consistently good football. But those individual uncoachable players is what grasps the imagination most for football fans. And that's why it didn't really matter what era he belonged in, that we can watch footage of him and just enjoy it and you can get lost in it. And that's why he resonated with so many people. And also because he was a brilliant personality, for better and for worse. He was, you know, he was a great character study.
Yeah, and we'll be chatting a lot more about Diego Maradona after the break with Jonathan Wilson. We'll be chatting about his new book as well, about Hungarian football, which sounds really interesting as well. If you haven't got a chance to look at that, it's called The Names We Heard Long Ago, and it's available now to read. If you want to get in touch with the show, you can text us on 53106. Send us in your Diego Maradona memories. Where was the first time you seen him? Did you grow up watching him in the World Cup? A lot of people have been sending in memories about watching the World Cup with their fathers and how it was the first thing that made them fall in love with football. So if you have anything like that or any other memories about Diego Maradona, send them in by text or you can tweet us at Team 33. That's all spelled out in words. Colin Buick, thanks for joining me today.
Thanks, Enda.
We'll take a quick break.
Diego Armando Maradona.
Here's Maradona again.
Maradona turns like a little eel and comes away from trouble.
Different class.
Chaga to his left and Valdano to his left. He doesn't get, he won't need any of them. Oh, you have to say that's magnificent. There is no debate about that goal. That was just pure football genius. And the crowd in the Azteca Stadium stand him.
Little squat man comes inside Budger, leaves him for dead. Outside Fenning leaves him for dead and puts the ball away. And that is why Maradona is the greatest player in the world. He picked up that ball 40 yards out. First he left one man for dead. First he went for Jackson. It's a goal of great quality by a player of the greatest quality. It's England 0, Argentina 2.
Continuing on our Diego Maradona chat, I'm delighted to say that Jonathan Wilson has joined me on the line. Jonathan, thanks for joining me.
Thanks for having me.
So it's been a weird couple of hours, a weird 24 hours for a lot of people, still sort of getting into the reality that Diego Maradona has left us. What are your feelings initially with Diego Maradona? I know this doesn't really come as a shock to many people because he was in ill health.
Yeah, I mean, it wasn't a shock because obviously, you know, we knew he'd had the issue with his brain that needed surgery a couple of weeks ago. But actually, I know, you know, obviously 60 is a very young age, but in some ways I'm glad that it happened quickly. I think the most awful thing is when you see somebody, particularly somebody who was so graceful and so athletic in their prime, you know, lingering horribly in death. And you know, we'll all have examples from our own families and our own friends, and sports people. And you know, you think of Jack Charlton with a dementia, what Bobby's going through now with a dementia. You think of George Best and what he looked like though those final months as he really struggled with the end of alcoholism. And at least Maradona didn't have that. And what he did have in his final year was he was working as a manager still. He was having his most successful period as a manager at Gimnasia. And so he was going around all these Argentinian grounds, and every ground was paying tribute to him. And it was like a farewell tour. And so the most absurd of these was at Newell's. And he only played for Newell's for seven games in 93. The first of which, at half time, there was a six-year-old boy did tricks on the pitch with the ball to entertain the crowd. Do you know who that was?
Diego Maradona?
No, Lionel Messi.
Oh, sorry, this was recently.
Yeah, this is, yeah. No, well, no, this was in 93 when he made his debut for
him. Oh, sorry.
Messi does tricks on the pitch at half-time, which is an extraordinary sort of coincidence. But anyway, so Newell's, a club he'd barely been at, but their fans, he meant so much to their fans that they built a throne for him. And so rather than sitting in the dugout, he manages the game, and it's technically from a throne. So, I mean, that's an extreme example, but every ground he went to, there was a celebration of him. So if there is a good way to go, then having a year of being told how much your country loves you isn't the worst way.
Yeah, I hadn't realised that. I knew he was still managing, and obviously social media now, you see the pictures of the throne going around, and you don't really put two and two together that this was sort of like a farewell tour. There's some interesting parts of Diego Maradona's managerial career that we might get to a little bit later, but I suppose one reason I thought you were talking about Maradona is that there's a reference to that in your piece in The Guardian, where you're talking about the childlike genius that became, that fulfilled the prophecy. And I thought it was a really nice farewell piece to him, because quite a lot of the obituaries, and this is what I'm more interested in, is how do you approach something like this when you have a character like Maradona? Because obviously he's flawed. Obviously he had issues. Everyone knows about those, or anybody who's read or watched anything to do with Diego Maradona will have known about those. How do you balance that with getting and writing and showing the people how much of a genius he was on the pitch without almost ignoring the bad aspects of his life?
Oh, you can't. You have to put everything in there, because the two things are intrinsically related. And you know, if somebody wrote a piece about Maradona today, and they just said, "Oh, look, he was a great player. He scored these great goals. He won the league twice with Napoli," and they didn't mention the three major handballs—not just one against England, but the one in the UEFA Cup final and the one against Soviet Union in the 1990 World Cup—and if they didn't mention the drugs, and they didn't mention the fact that actually he probably only had four or five consistently good seasons, and they didn't mention the fact that he failed the drug test at the 94 World Cup, and they didn't mention the red card in the 82 World Cup, it's all part of him. And there's no point trying to separate them out. I mean, firstly, your job as a journalist is to write what you believe to be true. But secondly, why do we write these pieces? We write them to remember and to commemorate the person he was. And the person he was deeply conflicted. And that is actually at the heart of a lot of the fascination about him. That there's something with Messi, who sort of came through, 2005, 2006-ish onto the wider consciousness. So for 14, 15 years, for all but maybe two or three of those, he's been sensationally brilliant. But there's almost something cold about that relentlessness. And there's a point that the journalist Rupert Fryer made this morning that I think is very apt. That the word that's used often of Messi is he's an alien. And because he's just, we can't quite understand it. It's just something else. We know it's great, but we don't quite get it. Whereas Maradona was a god, because he was made in a human image. And it's at a level way, way, way beyond what we could ever hope to do or hope even to comprehend. But we could see he suffered for his genius. We could see there's a terrible toll. And that at least we can understand, that these things are not normal and there's a price to be paid.
Yeah, exactly. And I think you summed it up pretty well, that the godlike figure had human aspects, and that's what people loved about Maradona and what made him relatable, I suppose. And I suppose context is everything. So if you look at the cold hard facts of the day, that he cheated in the World Cup, and that he was a drug cheat, and that he was involved in the mafia during his time in Napoli, it's a very cold figure, and you have to separate the two. But I suppose what you touch on in your piece about his upbringing, there's context to everything, and he had to fight for everything from the very beginning.
Yeah, I mean, I think there's a few things to be said there. I mean, first of all, he cheated in the World Cup. Well, sure, he did, but who's the bigger cheat? The guy who sees a ball dropping and thinks, well, if I just flick my hand, maybe I can score here. Or Terry Fenwick, who kicks the shit out of him, which is actually cheating.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a great line I saw from Terry Fenwick where he said he fouled him just after half time. I mean, he elbowed him in the first half. He should have been sent off and got away with. But obviously in England, we don't talk about that. Hmm. But Terry Fenwick said, you know, he absolutely clattered him beginning of the second half and thought, well, that's the last we'll see of him. And then he sees him bounce up and thinks, oh God, he's indestructible. And that I think is one of the things about him. He took an extraordinary beating on the pitch on a regular basis, and his courage in always wanting the ball, his ability to rebound from that, I think was extraordinary. And you know, the 86 World Cup, because he was still suffering the effects of the Goicoechea foul for Athletic against him, one leg was slightly longer than the other. He was having operations to correct that. So to do what he did in the 86 World Cup with one leg longer than the other, I think is even more amazing. So I don't think you can, I don't think we should separate it. He was a great player who was deeply flawed. His involvement with the Camorra was something, I think, beyond his control. I think that was, it was too great a force. He couldn't control that. What do you do when a Camorra boss invites you to dinner when you're the best player for Napoli? You can't say no. That's just how it works. And then you get more deeply involved. And of course, it suited the Camorra to encourage his addiction. And of course, I mean, there's all kinds of facile reasons we can come up with as to why he became addicted. But at least part of the reason is the cocaine gave him a release from the extraordinary pressure he was under. And that pressure was there partly because he was a world record signing. And, you know, that's a normal thing in football. We see players who have huge transfer fees struggle with the pressure and they deal with that in their own ways. But also his status in Argentina as a figure way beyond what any other player could ever be for any other country. That he was the image of how Argentina had seen itself and its football for 50 years. And, you know, I refer repeatedly to the piece by Boicotto, the editor of El Grafico in 1928, when he says, you know, we put up a statue to the soul of Argentinian football. And he essentially describes Diego Maradona, this squat kid with the dark hair and the holes in his shirt because of the poverty, his teeth worn down by eating stale bread because of the poverty, but the mischievous glint in his eye. And so when Maradona arrives, he's the fulfillment of the prophecy. And then it turns out he's brilliant as well as looking right and doing it right. And so when he scores those two goals against England, Argentinian football has been set up in opposition to British football. British football, as Argentinians saw it, was the football of the schools. You know, the British schools are how football's propagated through Argentina. And the British schools, you know, the British had a quasi-colonial relationship to Argentina from sort of 1870-ish to the beginning of the First World War. That happens because they import wire. And with wire, you can build fences. And if you can build fences, you don't need the gauchos, the cowboys. Mm-hmm. And the gauchos had all the political power. And, you know, wire fences trump gauchos. But the gaucho is seen as this very romantic, very heroic figure. You know, they're very solitary. They're very self-reliant. They ride horses. There's a flamboyance to them. And the great poem of Argentinian literature is Martin Fierro, which is about a gaucho. It's about the end of a gaucho period. But it becomes a celebration of a gaucho. And so as the First World War begins and the sort of European forces retreat, Argentina is left, having murdered most of its indigenous population, as an immigrant nation looking for an identity, looking for a role. And people find the spirit of Argentina in the pampas, in the gauchos. But that's, of course, nonsense in a city. Mm-hmm. It's got no place in an urbanizing world. And so that same spirit of self-reliance, of cleverness, of an ability to look after yourself, and yet still have a flamboyance, is found in the pibe, in the urchin kid of the streets. And Argentinian football is of the streets. It's the mass games on the potreros, on the vacant lots of a city, on the hard ground where you have too many people in too small a space, where it's all about technical skill. And there's not a teacher there with a whistle ready to stop things if somebody steps out of line. You've got to look after yourself. And so Argentinian football is the football of skill and streetwiseness, set in very distinct, in very direct contradistinction to British football, which is about fair play and running and hard work and effort.
Yeah.
And so when Maradona scores those two goals in 1986, in the first game between the nations since the end of the Falklands, 20 years after the previous quarterfinal, World Cup quarterfinal between the two teams, in which Alf Ramsey ends by calling Argentina animals, in which there's still a huge controversy over the sending off of Antonio Ratin, the Argentina captain, for him to score these two goals against England, both in their own ways of the PB, the handball, the cunning, the cleverness, the cheating, and then the brilliant dribble. And even the dribbling, the Argentinian word for a dribble that goes like that is gambetta. And that's a word that comes from a specific Gaucho dialect. And it's used to describe the running motion of the ostrich, that sort of in and out wobbling motion. So the whole thing is linked in. Everything Maradona does is an expression of his PB-ness. And that itself is an expression of the spirit of Argentina that was once expressed through the gaucho, that becomes expressed through the PB, and is then expressed through the footballer.
Wow, it's extremely interesting. I hadn't realised much of that at all about Argentina.
And that, of course, is why he's under so much pressure, because mm-hmm. he arrives as the Messiah. From the age of 16, he's the Messiah.
And it's not too often that the Messiah actually becomes the god that he did, like Maradona did. Tim Vickery was on with us last night talking about it. And of course, he's steeped in South American football. And he spoke about that in 1986 game and the context around it, and how Argentina had just become, had just released itself from the sort of colonialism of England. And he said that the way he described the first goal was beautiful. It was that Maradona was telling them, yes, you may rule us, but we can still dance around you all you want. And then the second goal was the revenge of all the years that they had to put up with it. And I know that we sometimes read too much into these things, and ultimately what it is two goals against England in the World Cup playing football. But there's not too many people that can actually hold the pressure of doing that. And Maradona took it on himself throughout his career to be that person.
Well, he did it at certain times in his career. I mean, in some ways, his career was an enormous disappointment.
Mm.
You know, he plays professional football for 20 years, in which he's really consistently good for maybe five. And there's a lot of periods when he's injured, when he's really struggling with fitness, when he's banned. I mean, he serves 30 months of drug bans.
Mm-hmm.
More than that, because the end of his career ends with a drugs ban. So there's three separate drugs bans he has. So at certain key moments, he could take that pressure on himself. And of course, for Argentina to do it in the World Cup or to do it against England is the perfect time to do it. For Napoli to do it, I mean, particularly the 87 Scudetto, again, it was the perfect time to do it.
Yeah. Where do we land on Maradona post-career and what he's done since? Because for a lot of generation, myself included, we didn't see Maradona play live. So we were left with this sort of shadow of a once great figure who clearly still had problems in his own personal life, had issues with maternity and children that he wouldn't recognize. He was overweight and limping from the resulting tackle of the Butcher of Bilbao and injuries that he's suffered throughout his career, taking injections of cortisone to get past the pain. But there just seemed to be that, again, that glint in his eye that there was something still there within him. And he looked like a man that had deep regret for a lot that happened. Do we know where he felt or where he was in his career in the last 10 years or so?
Well, I think this touches on what I said right at the start. I think the last year he was pretty content. I think and it was his one really good spell as a manager. And that's it's nice. I mean, it's a pathetic word, but it's good that he had that. But you're right. I mean, really from mid-90s onwards, you know, the very end of his career with Boca didn't go well. And from there, you know, he becomes this figure who... sometimes he'd be a pundit on TV and he'd be brilliant. And you think, oh God, this guy's just, his football brain is extraordinary. And then there's other times you'd be cringing because you knew that something wasn't quite right.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, he did become this sort of figure of fun to some, and that's not really how he should be remembered. But I'm not sure. How did he regard himself? I don't know. I suspect there was no consistent answer to that. I think there was a series of huge swings. I mean, there's a chat show he did. It must be, I would guess, about 15 years ago, when he breaks down during the chat show. And it's not like it's really kind of tough questioning. He's obviously just in an emotional state. Mm-hmm. And that is one of the most moving things I've ever seen, was his acknowledgement of his irresponsibility and his failure. But then it's not like that suddenly prompts him to kind of behave much better. So yeah, there's something sad about that end to his career. You look at his managerial reign with Argentina, and where do you begin with that?
Yeah,
I mean, I was in Argentina for a lot of that, and it was one of the most astonishing periods that. Yeah, Argentina lost to Chile. Which I hadn't done for, I don't know, like, I think since the 70s. And there was suddenly a real possibility that he might not qualify for the World Cup. This is for the 2010 World Cup.
Yeah.
And there's this huge public outcry of, oh, yeah, we need Diego. And for me as an outsider, like, what do you mean? He's only ever won two matches as a manager. Yeah, the last thing you need is Diego. But he turns up, and in 13 games, he picks, I think, 55 players. He brings back Martin Palermo, who was 36 at the time. And it's always, you know, they get beaten 6-1 in Bolivia because of Maradona's belief that if you fly in on the day of a game and fly straight out, somehow the altitude can't catch you. Well, it definitely can. And then they go into the penultimate game at home to Peru. And it's an extraordinary rainstorm. It's absolutely hammering down. The pitch is sort of underwater. And Palermo, you know, the most criticised of all the players he's brought in, scores this really scruffy Palermo-type goal in the last minute to get them a vital win. They then go to Montevideo to play Uruguay. And I think it's Borelli gets the goal with 6 minutes to go. And there's Maradona wearing this, and it was raining that night as well. And he's wearing this sort of red cagoule type thing and bouncing up and down. So it's like a cape behind him, like Superman's cape, but he's this sort of little fat man bouncing up and down the touchline. And then he comes in the press conference, he just unleashes his tirade of expletives at the press. And the whole thing is just mesmerizingly bizarre. And then, you know, he goes to the World Cup and he doesn't take any fullbacks to the World Cup. Well, he takes Gabriel Ente, but he doesn't take any right backs to the World Cup. He leaves Zanetti out, bizarrely. And, you know, they get through a group without playing particularly well. And then they end up getting absolutely hammered by a much cleverer, smarter Germany. But, you know, the thing I really remember from him at that World Cup was the Jabalani, the ball that nobody could control. And he sort of wobbles onto the pitch wearing these patent leather shoes. And suddenly smashes it into the top corner. And as if to say, well, look, I can do it. What's wrong with you? And that then reminded me that I'd seen him when I was at university. He came to speak at the university. And incredibly difficult to get tickets. And I was very lucky. I got in. I didn't get a seat, but I was standing at the back. But they had like a live video link to outside because so many people wanted to see him. And but, you know, he gives a speech, which is fine. And then somebody, he was questions at the end, somebody throws a golf ball towards, you know, not at him, but, you know, towards him and says, do something with that. And again, he's wearing a quite a tight suit and these little shiny patent leather shoes. And he traps his golf ball and just does the most incredible series of tricks in the wrong footwear with the wrong sort of ball. And you sort of think, well, that's... Yeah, it was just mesmerizing.
Yeah, wow. Jonathan, you've been great with your time. Before we finish up, we've spoken a lot about Argentinian football and the style of football and how successful they were during Diego Maradona's time, at least. You have a new book coming out about a country that a lot of people of my generation don't know all that much about in terms of their success and how many players they were producing back in the day. And I suppose a lot of people would know off the Puskás Award, probably don't know a lot about that person himself. Names we heard long ago. When is it out and what's it about?
Oh, it's been out for a couple of years now. So the paperback came out last year. But it's really about... okay, so my basis for this was I was doing a book on the Barcelona of the late 90s and of the extraordinary influence of that side. So you had Louis van Gaal as coach. You had Jose Mourinho and Ronald Koeman as his assistants. And you had in the team Pep Guardiola and Luis Enrique. They're the big five. And you think of the influence they've had on the world game. So I started thinking, if we can say modern football was born in Barcelona between sort of 1997 and 2000, is there any equivalent anywhere in the world? And I think there is one, and that's the MTK side of the Budapest team, MTK of sort of 1919 to 1922. And it had been, for various reasons, I'd sort of been fascinated by various people in the story for 15 years or so, and I'd done bits of research, and there's not a lot was known about them. This was proper research, going into archives and turning up things that people hadn't looked at for 80, 90 years, which as a researcher is, you know, hugely gratifying. It's a great feeling to sort of think, well, I've proved this, or I found this out that nobody has previously known. And so it's about the rise of Hungarian football, why Hungarian football really took off immediately after the First World War, how it took on the game had been left by British, essentially British bankers and merchants. And it culminates in Puskás and his team of the early 50s, who beat England 6-3 at Wembley in 53. They go on they win the Olympics in 52, which is part of a four-year unbeaten run, which comes to an end in the World Cup final in 54. And the very end is the Hungarian uprising in 56, when a load of players end up defecting. And so it's about that culture, how it came into being and the influence it had. And the reason it has such influence, and this is why it makes a great story, is that Hungary through the 20s and 30s went through incredible economic and political turmoil in, you know, horrific anti-Semitism, both at the beginning of the 20s and then getting much, much worse again as they get a far-right government towards the end of the 30s. And a lot of the great players and great coaches were Jewish. So there's this great diaspora. And so they go to Uruguay, they go to Argentina, they go to Brazil, they go to France, to Sweden, to Denmark, to Yugoslavia, to Germany, to Austria. Essentially, the whole of football has been influenced in some point in its history by Hungary. The only World Cup winning nation, that hasn't been directly influenced, I would say, by the Hungarians is England. But the experience of the humiliation in 53 and then the 7-1 defeat in 54 forced English football to rethink itself. So Hungarian football has had this profound influence. And a lot of the stories are heroic, they're tragic, because it's about two world wars and then the communist takeover and the uprising. So it's a tragic book in some ways, it's a heroic book in some ways. And a lot of these figures are larger than life. They do extraordinary things. They take extraordinary risks and they're great storytellers and they had a profound influence on how football's played today.
I think Sid Lowe touched on that in his book, Fear and Loathing in the La Liga, about Barcelona and Real Madrid. It was a Puskás that just about managed to get out of Hungary. He had to change his passport around and sneak his way out.
There's a couple of figures. Yeah. So Puskás, Puskás played for Honved, which was the army team. And the uprising happens November 56. And Honved were on their way, I think, to Bilbao to play Athletic in the European Cup tie. And so they were already in Bruges when the uprising happened. Or Brussels, maybe. Belgium, anyway. And they end up going on a tour to South America. And they played three games in Brazil, three games in Venezuela. And a load of players didn't go back. So Puskás, Coxish and Shebo didn't go back. So three of their forwards, three of their best players, never returned. And Puskás, I mean, he's banned by FIFA for a while for breaking his contract. But yeah, he ends up joining the great Real Madrid side. But the guy who persuades him to join Real Madrid is another Hungarian called Emil Österreicher, who had also fled. Shebo and Coxish end up playing for Barcelona. Barcelona already had a Hungarian defector, László Kubala. He was a statue of outside the Camp Nou, you know, maybe their greatest ever player.
Okay.
Certainly the player who elevated Barcelona. And you know, his story is ridiculous. You know, he's just had a kid and I think I think his wife was Slovakian. And she manages to escape with the kid. She swims across the Danube, pushing the kid in a tire. And he disguises himself as a Soviet soldier and gets in a truck, and they drive to the Austrian border. And every time a Hungarian stops them, they pretend to be Russian and, you know, claiming to be Soviet armies. So the Hungarians are like, oh, okay, that's fine. And then they get to the border and they walk across and appeal for asylum. And they're eventually reunited in Italy, him and his wife. And the baby falls ill from being pushed across the Danube. And Kubala had been invited to play for Torino in a friendly in Lisbon. Again, he'd been banned, but he was looking to what he could do when his ban had been served, and he was allowed to play in a friendly. And because his kid was ill, he didn't go. And it was on the return from Lisbon that the Torino team crashed into the hillside of Superga and were wiped out.
Wow.
And the coach of that team was Egri Epstein, who was another one of these Hungarians who'd fled Budapest. So yeah, the stories are awful and astonishing, and you see great heroism and strength there as well.
Wow, well, that sounds great. And if anybody's looking for something to read in lockdown 15, 20, I don't know when we're eventually going to get out of the continuous lockdowns, but if you're looking for something to read, The Names Heard Long Ago by Jonathan Wilson is out now, and you can get it wherever, in every bookstore, I presume, and online and on Amazon, all over the place, I suppose.
Absolutely, yeah.
All right, good stuff, Jonathan. Thanks very much for joining me today. That was great.
Cheers, thanks, enjoyed that.